Okay, good afternoon. My name is Todd Peterson, and this presentation is called Negro Leagues Equals Major Leagues. How good were the Negro Leagues? Well, many of the ball players who participated in segregated baseball are rated very highly. The leagues themselves are generally held in lower esteem. The website baseballreference.com classifies the outfits as Negro Majors and groups them below the American and National Leagues in the organizational hierarchy, along with Japanese baseball and the minor leagues. However, I believe the black circuits were every bit as good as their white counterparts. Through the use of historical evidence and statistical analysis, I will demonstrate that the Negro Leagues were equal to the major leagues and should be included in the official record, along with commensurate membership in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Negro League teams had a winning record against major league squads. Between 1869 and 1948, top-flight African-American clubs played over 7,000 games with white semi-pro, college, minor league, and major league teams and beat them nearly 65% of the time. Drawing on statistics from these contests, games played in the Negro Leagues, and the events of post-integration baseball, several indisputable truths emerge. From the first year of the American League in 1900 through the last year of the second Negro National League in 1948, African-American teams posted a record of 309 wins, 268 losses, and 20 ties, good for a 534 percentage against major league clubs and big league all-star aggregations. Against intact major league teams, black squads posted a record of 46, 56, and 7. However, from the inception of the Negro National League in 1920 through 1924, African-American teams went 29, 30, and 2. In head-to-head competition. Because the white mainstream press was often reluctant to record black club successes, the Negro League's overall tally is likely better than the big leaguers. After the Chicago American Giants edged the Major League stacked Camp Grant team in 1918, the Chicago Defender reported that, so stinging was the defeat that the downtown daily papers omitted on purpose the write-up in their sports columns. When the overall batting, pitching, and fielding statistics from the head-to-head games are tabulated, the big leaguers hold a slight edge. However, the gap between the two entities closed during the first 5 years of Negro League's play, and black squads wound up with a better overall slugging percentage, hit twice as many triples, and smashed more home runs and stole more bases. After black teams posted an 8-3-1 record against the Detroit Tigers, Philadelphia Athletics, and St. Louis Browns in 1923, baseball commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis forbade big leaguers from appearing at specific major league clubs or wearing their own uniforms and insisted that they advertise themselves as all-star teams, with only three World Series participants allowed to appear at any one time. The annual practice of African-American teams playing premier white players was an established tradition in cities such as New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Indianapolis, Chicago, St. Louis, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Between 1907 and 1948, black clubs defeated the best white batters, pitchers, and teams they were allowed to play over 55% of the time. The All-Star squads included in this tally were comprised of five or more players with big league experience, including the starting pitcher, and at least three players who had appeared in the majors that particular season. The number of the big leaguers involved in many of these games was actually higher, as the major leaguers often resorted to the uses of aliases to avoid detection. As for the far-fetched notion that big leaguers were not giving it their all, it should be noted that between 1901 and 1950, major league squads racked up a record of 2,674 wins against 907 losses and 71 ties against minor leaguers, semi-pro, college, and military teams, good for 742 percentage. Only the Negro Leaguers had their number. During these All-Star games, the Negro Leaguers significantly outperformed the big leaguers in almost every hitting, pitching, and fielding category, except assists and walks. However, as the black teams outslugged the major leaguers by nearly 40 points, they didn't need to be very patient at the plate. When the combined results of the games between the Negro League squads and major league teams of varying composition are tabulated, the black clubs are again revealed to lead in almost every hitting, pitching, and fielding statistical category. The big leaguers drew more walks and hit 13 more doubles over the course of 461 games. Amazingly, both sides fielded at an identical 951 clip, but the Negro Leaguers turned more double plays. With the near disappearance of the African-American major league pitcher, it is also interesting to note The black twirlers decisively outpace their big league counterparts in runs allowed, strikeouts, preventing base runners, and shutouts. The Negro Leagues compare favorably to the major leagues in several statistical categories. Connie Mack once said that pitching makes up 70% of baseball. Historians John Thorne and Pete Palmer have asserted that the figure is more like 44%, but noted it is undeniably important. It is not a stretch, then, to say that the truest indicator of a baseball league's quality would be the strength of its pitching, and that circuits with lower batting, slugging, and on-base percentages are superior to those with higher averages. For example, when the hitting averages of the major leagues and those of the three highest minors, the International League, American Association, Pacific Coast League, are considered, from 1912, the year the three organizations were elevated to AA status, until 1945, the last year of segregation, the majors consistently posted the lower batting totals. However, when the major league averages are compared to those of the Negro Leagues, a different truth emerges. Using statistics from the first season of the International League of Independent Professional Baseball Clubs of 1906 through the last campaign of the Negro National League in 1948, the batting totals of the significant black squads are noticeably lower than those of the major leagues. Once Negro League play began in 1920, black ball pitchers induced lower batting totals than their major league contemporaries in nearly every season until the early 1940s. Only the loss of manpower caused by player defections to Latin America, World War II, and integration tilted the field back towards the big leaguers. In addition, black hurlers annually allowed far fewer walks and hits than the big leaguers and struck out many more batters. Although bases and balls were not as carefully documented by Negro League scorekeepers as their major league counterparts, the black ball totals are certainly in the ballpark, and the similarly slighted strikeout totals are eye-popping enough as it is. There's an even more direct comparison between the two entities. Between 1911 and 1929, 9 Cuban War Negro Leaguers crossed over to play in the major leagues. Although the sample size was relatively small, 1,450 Negro League at-bats to 3,000 Major League at-bats, 223 Negro League innings pitched against 251 Major League innings pitched, the results are revelatory. The Cubans posted lower batting totals, allowed more runs per game, and had a lesser winning percentage while facing Negro League competition. The Negro Leagues did not top the majors in every statistical category. Black ball pitchers allowed more runs per game, and their fielders committed more errors on average than big league players did. Negro League base runners did steal many more bases, though. However, a closer inspection of the factors between the numbers again reveals a basic equivalency. For example, the disparity in errors could be attributed mostly to poor playing conditions. There were few, if any, grounds crews in the Negro Leagues, and baseballs and gloves were used until they fell apart. It should be noted that at 461 head-to-head contests where the playing conditions were equal, the difference between scoring between the two entities is probably the amount of errors per game was about the same, 1.85. Similarly, the difference in scoring between the two entities is probably not due to inferior pitching, but more likely because of the Negro League's more vibrant style of play. Black Ball Hall of Famer James Cool Papa Bell observed that the major leaguers followed the tenets of written baseball and played for one big inning. Negro Leaguers, on the other hand, relied more on unwritten baseball, throwing curveballs on 3-2 counts, bunting in the first inning, and hitting away in bunting situations. Negro League clubs were markedly better than minor league teams. While Negro League teams more than held their own while playing major league squads, they absolutely dominated Bush Leaguers. From the turn of the 20th century through 1948, black ball clubs played more than 1,300 games with minor league teams and all-star outfits, beating them nearly 60% of the time. When the batting records of the Negro Leagues and those of the three double, later AAA leagues, are compared, the African-American clubs posted lower batting averages indicating a higher level of play in almost every year from the mid-teens until integration, faltering ever so slightly in but four seasons. The New League's WHIP and K-9 pitching numbers also compare favorably to those of the high minors. From 1912 through 1948, Negro League pitchers allowed far fewer base runners than the AAA brethren in almost every season but five, and they failed to strike out more batters just twice. Negro League players flourished after entering organized baseball. During the 15 years following Jackie Robinson's 1946 debut with the Montreal Royals, at least 332 former Negro Leaguers entered organized baseball. 76 of these players eventually made it to the major leagues, while 125 competed in the three AAA circuits. Not every player was successful, but on the whole, and despite incredible hardships, the former Negro Leaguers outperformed their white counterparts. During the 30 years after integration, ex-Negro League players outhit their white competition in both AAA and the major leagues by a substantial margin. Nine of the former Negro Leaguers who entered organized baseball were eventually elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame, including Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, generally acknowledged as two of the five greatest players of all time. In 1952 alone, ex-Negro League players topped the leaderboard in 44 minor league hitting and pitching categories. Beginning in 1955, former Negro Leaguers led the National League in total bases for nine consecutive seasons. More dubiously, in the 12 of the 13 years between 1949 and 1961, the player hit by the most pitches in the American League had gotten a start in the Negro Leagues. Negro League pitchers also performed well in organized ball. 44 black curlers made it as far as AAA, while 21 of their number reached the majors. However, the majority of major league teams preferred to hang on to the races past. By the end of the 1951 season, 5 full years after Jackie Robinson signed with the Dodgers, only 5 out of the 16 big league clubs had black players on their rosters. Perversely, the organizations that did integrate strictly adhered to the unwritten 50-50 rule, wherein no more than 4 black players could be in a team's lineup at any one time. The end result was that of this woefully slow process was that several qualified African Americans were left languishing in the minors until their opportunity to play in the major leagues had passed them by. As the former Negro Leaguers led the charge in organized baseball, a new generation of black players fell closely behind, bypassing the segregated circuits altogether. 68 members of this first wave got as far as AAA during the first 10 years of integration, while 54 graduated to the major leagues by the close of the 1959 season. Although hampered by a rigid quota system, this first generation of black players hit well above league average in both the majors and high minor circuits. The new generation of black pitchers also performed well given the chance. Despite allowing fewer runs and base runners while striking out more batters at both levels over a period of 30 years, the black twirler became an endangered species due to institutional racism by big league front offices. By 1968, fewer than 1 in 10 major league pitchers were black. When the 1986 season started, only 5.7% of the major league African Americans were pitchers. Black players have dominated the post-segregation era. In 1955, the initial wave of black players won 23 Class B, C, or D minor league batting and pitching titles. During the 1959 season, this first generation led the three AAA circuits in 14 different statistical categories. In 1962, a black player led the National League in games played, at-bats, runs, hits, doubles, triples, home runs, runs batted in, stolen bases, total bases, batting average, slugging percentage, and, of course, being hit by pitches. In 1967, 40 black players, 5.5% of a total 718 big leaguers, accounted for more than half of the base hits made in the major leagues. 12 out of the top 15 National League batters in 1969 were black, along with 5 out of the top 6 batters in the junior circuit. As African American failed to lead the National League in slugging only twice between 1954 and 1978. In the 39 seasons from 1959 until 1997, a black player won the National League batting crown 32 times. Since 1947, a non-black player has led the National League in stolen bases only 4 times. In the 52 seasons between 1965 and 2016, black players captured 45 American League stolen base crowns. In In the entire history of Major League Baseball, only four batters have hit for 5,900 or more total bases, and three of them, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Barry Bonds, are African-Americans. Despite getting a 71-year late start, eight of the top 10 all-time home run hitters are black. Only Aaron, Mays, Alex Rodriguez, and Albert Pujols have over 3,000 hits and 600 home runs. Not one of the four would have been allowed in the majors before 1947. From 1947 through 2013, African-American players won 47 Most Valuable Player awards, and Latinos 21, more than half of the 134 total. Non-white players have contributed at least one-third of the yearly wins above replacement in the big leagues since the early 1960s, and have hovered around the 40% mark since 1990. As historian Mark Moore surmised, without integration, Major League Baseball would be immeasurably worse. From 1959 through 1985, the league with the most black players on their squad, i.e. the National, won 27 out of 31 All-Star games with one tie. Between 1947 and 1973, big league hitters produced more hits, doubles, triples, home runs, and stole more bases on average than their white batters. During that same time frame, black pitchers struck out more hitters and allowed fewer base runners per inning. The legacy of the Negro Leagues is clear. Since integration, the best players in the major leagues have been black. Evidence would indicate that the best players have always been black. The black population of the major leagues has surpassed that of the Negro Leagues. Despite being vastly outnumbered in the general population, black athletes have long dominated the upper echelons of many American amateur and professional sports. In 2016, for example, blacks comprised only 13% of the United States demographic, and yet 69% of the players of the National Football League and 81.7% of the National Basketball Association were people of color. Due to expansion, there are now nearly twice as many major leaguers than there were during the segregated era, 750 to 400. Perhaps not coincidentally, this player increase, 350, is equal to the yearly average of black major leaguers since 1969. In fact, in every season since 1995, the number of black major leaguers has been the same or larger than the amount of white big leaguers during the segregated era. Conversely, during the lifetime of the Negro Leagues, the rosters of black ball clubs ranged anywhere from 14 to 20 players, although team photographs of the period rarely reveal squads larger than 16. Given that there were on average 13 league or league-associated franchises from 1920 until 1948, the average population of big-time black ball on any given day was about 207 players. Even with the decline in African-American participation, the number of black major league players has been higher than the average population of the Negro Leagues in every season since 1969, and the apex of organized black ball, around 377 players during the chaotic 1932 season, has been surpassed by black big leaguers every year since 1995, because at least 425 African-Americans and Latinos currently play big league baseball. Every year, there are now more black major leaguers annually than there ever were during the Negro League players. It is a safe assumption that the 20th century black ball circuits, with yearly populations that rarely exceeded 300 players, were big league as well. Major League Baseball has colonized the history and the culture of the Negro Leagues. A more subtle recognition of the Negro League's quality has occurred on the playing field. On August 3, 1994, at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, the hometown Royals defeated the Oakland Athletics 9-5 while wearing replica uniforms of the 1924 Kansas City Monarchs. During the following 24 seasons, big league squads have put on throwback uniforms to Negro League teams with the MLB emblem on their sleeves over 80 times. Sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words. Historian Rob Nyer once postulated that a major league required teams populated but largely by the sport's best players playing a set and lengthy schedule. Because black ball teams usually did not own their own ballparks, their schedules were a lot more piecemeal than organized baseball's. However, Negro League squads played a lot of games. Between 1920 and 1927, the Hilldale Club averaged 163 contests per season. Operating as an independent team in 1931, the Homestead Grays played 174 games, mostly around this area. As for having the best players, African and Latin Americans have dominated the major leagues since 1947, and they now make up over one-third of MLB's yearly population. Negro leaguers beat big league teams more than half the time in head-to-head contests, demonstrated better pitching and league play, and performed well above average when they're finally allowed in the majors. In other words, Negro Leagues equals Major Leagues. Thank you.
I think one of the reluctances, the reasons why the powers that be are reluctant to declare the Negro Leagues major leagues is because we're obsessed with complete records and balanced schedules and that level of organization. But it seems to me that there should be no problem to recognize them as being of major league caliber and with the footnote that we don't have complete records because they were marginalized by society and weren't allowed to own their ballparks or to conduct a major league in terms of the logistics, but that should be a very separate being of major league caliber in terms of the playing. So your comments on that?
Right. Well, yeah, but you know, there's more and more stats coming out every day. So I mean, thanks to Gary Ashwell's work on seam heads and Baseball Reference and Larry Lester and his group. You know, there's a lot of information coming out, so a lot of the gaps are being filled in. So I don't think you could say anymore that we don't have records. We can't really compare. The numbers are there. It may never get to complete, but you know there's problems with MLB records as well. You know, so. And there are many different leagues, but it's, you know.
Hello? My comment relates mainly to the first half of the century. We all know there were very great players in the Negro Leagues, but we also all know that the average young man, whatever his race, can't play Major League Baseball, so that to put together a whole league, you need a huge population to draw from. Now, we start with the black population in the United States being about 10% of the total. But more than that, in 1939, there were 16 major league teams, and there were over 300 minor league teams. That's a huge population of young men who, because of segregation, were all white, and that whole population is playing full-time baseball, and the whole purpose of having those minor leagues is to identify the best people, get them up to the major leagues, etc. And there's nothing comparable on the Negro League side. Under those circumstances, see how the average player in the Negro Leagues could possibly be as good as the average player in the major leagues.
Well, I know, but I would point out 13% of the population in 2016 is African American, but yet we're, if you look at the NFL and the NBA, admittedly different organizations, the total is very high.
That's because in those sports, the training grounds, the high school and college, are dominated by African Americans. That's the population the pros are coming from. But the population that professional baseball players were coming from in the first half of the century was 90% white or more. Well, I was about 9 million. It's not very much. Well, but again, I'm not talking about the Dominican Republic because I'm talking about the first half of the century.
Well, I would just say if the game's best players, many of them are playing in one area, I think that would make it a major league. And there were minor leagues. There was a Negro Southern League. There were minor leagues that the Negro Leagues would draw from. It wasn't a haphazard organization. They knew where the players were. They didn't have as many minor leagues admittedly, but there was an organization there to draw from and players they would draft and bring up.
But on a whole different scale. Okay, I've had my say. Thank you.
One thing that your research is showing is that there was a lot of competitive interaction between Negro League players and we'll call them white players of various levels of competition. Yeah. Okay, what is missing, though not completely from your work, just what is missing is what I call the common opponents idea. Okay, if the major leagues players occasionally play a AAA team and beat the tar out of them, okay, you need to ask, and you need to break your data down and say, okay, how well did Negro League teams do against that particular AAA team? In other words, you need one baseline constant. This is the only way to make the choice, but you need a baseline constant. What I've heard and the data I've seen, but I've been up 5 years behind, is that in the 30s, when the Negro Leagues got to play against whites, although a lot of them were prohibited from being in there, the whites apparently weren't very good pitchers because the Negro League stats actually went up. The hitters hit more home runs, more hits, doubles, triples, et cetera, if there was a white guy on the mound. That indicates that, at least, that the participants in these games, not necessarily the Negro Leagues in general, but the participants in this game were, in fact, major league quality players. But how good major league quality players they might be depends upon how good were the white guys willing to pitch against them.
Yeah.
I mean, in all fairness.
I don't have the MLB data against. I just have the general data, not specifically against particular teams as of yet.
There's a fella in Clemson University. I always thought he was doctor, but it turns out his initials are simply DR. D.R. Randy Cox has a lot of data on when it was whites on one side and blacks on another, and he might even have some box scores where we can find out who were the whites and who were the blacks, because it seems to me that might matter a bit.
Well, I think I will certainly consult with him. Thank you. Yeah.